Once again, his eyes missed it over. I said he'd have to teach me to play. He withheld his appraisal of my competitive prospects. The skeptical once-over he gave me didn't bode well. Like Petraeus, Dostum correctly surmised my athletic prowess. But he invited me to Shebergon to watch. He warned gravely that his team had grown strong enough to best him on occasion. In his prime, Dostum was unbeatable. Dostum spent brief stretches as an oil refinery worker, a plumber, and a wrestler, but war was his true discipline. He was conscripted into army service as a teenager and rose through the ranks, effortlessly mastering the low-tech cavalry combat of his ancestors. Later, he joined the Afghan army, staying aligned with them and the Soviets, even as the anti-Soviet Mujahideen gained strength. Those anti-Soviet fighters were, over the course of the 1980s, flooded with American money and guns. Ronald Reagan dubbed them freedom fighters, and they became a cause celeb for Americans gripped by red panic. A Texas socialite named Joanne Herring, all fake lashes and big hair and scriptural quotations, managed to goad her lover at the time, a louche alcoholic congressman named Charlie Wilson, into drumming up support on the Hill. At the peak of the pro-Mujahideen frenzy, Congress was allocating more money to the fighters than the CIA wanted. That many of the anti-Soviet Mujahideen were radical hardliners was, at the time, a feature, not a bug. By the mid-1980s, the CIA was even commissioning local language translations of the Quran and paying to distribute them by the thousand behind Soviet lines. Milt Bearden, the CIA handler who brokered some of the relationships with the Mujahideen, defended that thinking years later. "Let's be clear about one thing. Moderates never won anything," he told me. "Moderates don't win wars." The CIA was more concerned with small-scale tactical challenges. "You had to make things Muj-proof," Bearden recalled of the equipment being dispersed. "So we couldn't put the pink wire on the green post and then screw it down and then, bam, it blows him up." He laughed thunderously. "A couple of guys got blown up, but they weren't suicides." Not then, anyway. This was history that would echo uncannily after 9/11, when the United States again banked on the enemy's enemy to turn the tide. Even Joanne Herring cropped up again in that later era, bursting into the State Department in a cloud of perfume and hairspray during my time there. She was 80, taut and tweaked and still saving Afghanistan, this time by soliciting hundreds of millions of dollars for a coalition of development groups she ran, dubbed the Marshall Plan charities. She took me by the hand and called me a blessing, and had the diplomats of the South and Central Asia Bureau join hands and pray before a meeting. Eyes pressed shut, she delivered an impassioned prayer to the Lord and to the commander's emergency response program funds she wanted. After she left, Holbrook shook his head in disbelief and called her something too colorful to repeat here. When I asked Herring about her role in propping up the Mujahideen, in the view of some laying the foundations for 9/11, she grew testy, saying the Stinger missiles provided to the fighters had a limited shelf life and her legacy ended with those. When Aaron Sorkin's original script to Charlie Wilson's War, the Hollywood film of Herring's and Wilson's fight to rally support for the Mujahideen, ended on a shot of smoke coming out of the Pentagon on 9/11, Herring was reported to have had her lawyer's saber rattle until it was changed. But the film still ends on a cautionary note. As the Soviets withdraw and Wilson celebrates, the CIA agent, Gust Avrakotos, tells the story of a Zen master who sees a young boy being given a horse and his village celebrating the blessing. "We'll see," says the Zen master. When the boy falls off the horse and breaks his leg, and the villagers declare the horse a curse, the master only offers another, "We'll see." Later, when war breaks out and the boy avoids conscription due to his injuries, the village celebrates the horse as a gift again. "We'll see," the master says again. As Wilson takes in the implications, we hear a plane roar by overhead. Dostum was no radical, but by the end of the Cold War, he had proved himself dangerous in other ways. His religion was survival, which he ensured through a dizzying succession of crosses and double crosses. Even during his years commanding the most powerful unit in the Soviet-aligned army, he kept contact with the Mujahideen commanders on the other side of the battlefield and mused openly about defecting to their cause. The pragmatism paid off. As the Soviet grip on Afghanistan weakened, Ahmed Shah Massoud, the favored son of the Americans among the Mujahideen, passed word to Dostum that the Soviet regime felt threatened by Dostum's growing popularity and was planning to force him out. Dostum crossed Moscow before Moscow could cross him, joining his 40,000 soldiers with the Islamist Mujahideen he had been fighting for years on the battlefield. The move proved decisive in tilting the balance of power against the Soviets. After the Soviets pulled out, the former freedom fighters descended on Kabul and drenched it in blood. Dostum was on the front lines. His militias were reported to be behind a campaign of rapes and executions. But when a new government began to take shape, he found himself frozen out. As ministerial positions were doled out to the other commanders, Dostum retreated to his fiefdom in the north, where his power diminished as the Taliban encroached. When his second-in-command betrayed him and defected to the Taliban in 1997, he fled the country altogether to Turkey. By early 2001, though, Dostum was back, arraying his tattered forces against the Taliban. He would soon become an expedient solution to the United States' latest problem in Afghanistan. America's limited options in the region after 9/11 and the resulting decision to arm Dostum and his fellow warlords were a direct result of a vacuum of diplomacy. By some combination of ideological opposition, inertia, and inattention, no one had sought a meaningful conversation for years with the medieval Taliban regime that had harbored bin Laden in Afghanistan. American officials did take a number of meetings with the Taliban over the course of the 1990s, but all were either perfunctory or focused on the narrow demand that the Taliban turn over bin Laden. Despite advocacy from supporters of dialogue like Robin Rafel, those meetings never evolved into anything resembling real negotiations. In early 2001, as the threat from the region became more dire, the United States did champion UN Security Council sanctions, entailing an arms ban and a freeze of Taliban assets. But it was all sticks, no carrots. Sanctions were not an attempt to bring the Taliban to the table. This was about breaking a brutal regime. In the late 1990s, the United Nations briefly pushed broader regional dialogue that showed promise. Lakhdar Brahimi, the Algerian UN envoy to Afghanistan, maintained civil contact with the Taliban's second-in-command, Mullah Mohammad Rabbani, who was skeptical of his group's growing dependence on Al-Qaeda and deepening bond with Osama bin Laden. A Taliban official even joined as an observer at 1999 talks in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, between the Americans, Russians, and Afghanistan's six regional neighbors to discuss a peaceful resolution to the country's civil conflict. But these efforts were swiftly overpowered by the United States military alliance of choice in the region with Pakistan. Just days after the countries at Tashkent agreed to stop arming the parties to the Afghan conflict, Pakistan worked with the Taliban to launch a major offensive against opposing military commanders. After the September 11 attacks, opportunities for negotiated settlements were dismissed or undermined. When General Dostum's forces, working with the Americans, surrounded the Taliban stronghold of Kunduz, there was a three-day negotiation process involving Dostum and more than a dozen American Special Forces officers and intelligence agents. Taliban, who had peacefully surrendered, were offered a generous deal. They could return to their villages safely in exchange for laying down arms, with the exception of targets of high intelligence value chosen by the Americans. In exchange, Dostum promised two Taliban generals, Mohammad Fazl and Nurullah Nuri, amnesty, which he publicly announced as a sign of wider reconciliation to come. But both commanders soon wound up at Guantanamo Bay. It was, for years, a subject of mystery and consternation for those following Afghanistan's descent into chaos. Fazl and Nuri were by your side, and you were promising them amnesty, then they end up in Guantanamo, I started to ask Dostum. He grunted. Short question. I don't feel good. Did the Americans pressure you to turn them over? I pressed. Dostum laughed mightily. I didn't surrender them to the United States forces, but they didn't take by force. They came to take them, and I told them, listen, they're Taliban, they are Muslim. I am also Muslim. You are not Muslim. If I surrender them, if I give them to you, I will be blamed. General Dostum is a Muslim, but he gave the Taliban to the Americans. It would damage my credibility. Bush was talking on the TV about how to approach prisoners, he said, referring to early comments about respecting the Geneva Conventions. Then the military people came and said, listen, we have to implement the order. I don't care what Bush says. If I want to take them, I will take them. Dostum shrugged. He was wiggling his knees, restless. I said, okay, whatever you want. In the early months of the war in Afghanistan, that same dynamic played out repeatedly, including in Kandahar, where Hamid Karzai's attempts at reconciliation were overruled by Donald Rumsfeld, who bristled at the thought of dealing with the Taliban. That the United States shunned negotiation with the Taliban in favor of military action in the immediate aftermath of the attacks was little surprise. To suggest diplomacy over force in dealing with the regime that harbored the perpetrators of the 9/11 attack was akin politically to proposing a national program of cannibalism in public schools. But that recalcitrance continued long after the Taliban had been thwarted on the battlefield. There was never a concerted effort to embed military gains in a larger strategic context, and for years, there was no political space to acknowledge what had become obvious. That the total defeat and elimination of the Taliban was not possible, and that, barring that, peace would only come through diplomacy. Instead, in the weeks after the terrorists plunged hijacked planes into America's centers of power and its consciousness, the debate over how to respond took place almost entirely within the military and intelligence community. There were those, like the CIA station chief in Islamabad at the time, who wanted to continue to work solely through the United States military alliance with Pakistan, using the Pakistanis to pressure the Taliban regime they had for years supported to surrender Osama bin Laden. Others, back in the CIA's counterterrorism center in Washington, had a simpler suggestion. Give American guns to anyone who could fight the Taliban. Before any coherent policy could be developed across the U.S. government, that latter faction began quietly executing its proposal. And anyone who could fight the Taliban meant the warlords and brigands of the Northern Alliance. Robin Rafel, who had fought long and hard for negotiation with the Taliban, despaired at the choice. We didn't need to be fighting the Taliban. They realized who we were and the power that we had. They wanted to go home, and we wouldn't have it. We were the tough guys, right? She rolled her eyes. And we rode in with the Northern Alliance on donkeys. It was such nonsense. Sorry, but it was. In December 2001, the United Nations led a half-hearted attempt to build a new Afghan government, culminating in talks in Bonn, Germany. The Taliban, the vanquished party and an indispensable part of any sustainable political settlement, was absent from the talks. The conference was instead dominated by the Northern Alliance fighters the Americans had chosen to rely on in their initial military offensives. For the diplomats who had pushed for dialogue, it was an elementary failure. I said from the beginning that they, the Taliban, should have been at Bonn, Rafel later told me. That was our biggest mistake. Barnett Rubin, who was part of the UN team that organized the talks and had a desk near mine in Holbrooke's State Department offices, often told me that exclusion had far-reaching repercussions. The Bonn Agreement did make Afghan government and politics more inclusive, but it could not overcome U.S. counterterrorism policy, which dictated the exclusion of the Taliban, he later wrote. Immediately after the talks concluded, Taliban leaders even reached out to newly installed Afghan interim president Hamid Karzai to offer a truce in exchange for amnesty, an offer that was immediately overruled by Donald Rumsfeld and the Americans. Taliban leaders who swore fealty to the new central government and returned to their villages were hunted down and captured, often by Northern Alliance warlords. These new foot soldiers in America's war on terror made for an unpleasant rogues gallery. Abdul Sayyaf, a former mentor to Osama bin Laden, had helped establish the training camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan that formed the bedrock of modern Islamist terrorism, and was behind a bloody massacre of Shiite Hazaras during the struggle for Kabul after the Cold War. Burhanuddin Rabbani's forces, working with Sayyaf's, were accused of slaughtering the elderly, children, even dogs during that siege. Mohammed Mohaqiq and his men were implicated in murders, rapes, and systematic looting in the months after 9/11. His militia's trademark? Kidnapping young girls and forcing them into marriage. Atta Mohammed Noor's militias were behind a campaign of looting and rapes targeting ethnic Pashtuns in the same period. And then there was Atta's rival in countless bloody skirmishes, Abdul Rashid Dostum. When and how Dostum started working with the Americans was a matter of some dispute. Hank Crumpton, the CIA official who, as head of the agency's newly formed Special Activities Division, oversaw the initial response to September 11, later told me that the agency had been developing its relationship with the warlord for some time before 9/11, working through an Uzbek-fluent agent named Dave Tyson. Dostum insisted that Tyson only got in touch after the attacks. What's not disputed is that a CIA team came, and then a unit of Green Berets from the Army's 5th Special Forces Group, codenamed 595. It was a peculiar union. Dust kinda settles, and out of the dust comes the Sand People, Team Sergeant Paul Evans recalled. You see a man with an AK who's dressed just like your enemy, and you've gotta walk over to him and basically ask him, "Hey, how you doing?" And you have no idea whether he's gonna put out his hand or shoot you. One of those Sand People was General Dostum. "General Dostum and his advanced security party come riding up," said Captain Mark Nooch. "He jumps down off his horse and, hell, the horse was still moving and he jumps off. He's like, 'Hey,'" interjected Chief Warrant Officer Bob Pennington, making an expansive gesture. "General Dostum agreed to take my team members and I up to his forward command post," Nooch went on, "so we would mount horses for the first time in combat." An Air Force controller who joined several days later to coordinate strikes from Lockheed AC-130 gunships and asked to be identified only by his first name, Bart, said the effect was like a time machine. "You're like, what year am I in? You just got off a 21st century helicopter, sophisticated avionics and everything else on it, and now we've gone back in time." He and the other Americans rode horses while supplies were strapped to donkeys led by Afghans. They slept in a series of frozen mountain caves, with only candles and flashlights to cut through the pitch black, so far from any city lights. "When you rode a horse through the mountains, the stars felt like they were right there in your face," Bart went on. "You were riding into the stars. It was something else." Most of all, he remembered Dostum's stature, both in his literal physical size and in terms of the reverence he commanded. "Oh, he was the man," he told me. "He was the leader. Those Northern Alliance guys would set his tent up and he would have these pillow beds in there. They carried those on donkey for him. He was laying in comfort. We were laying in a ditch." The Americans airdropped supplies, chief among them hundreds of guns. Not the sophisticated weaponry carried by the Americans, but aging Russian Kalashnikovs. Cash came, but, Dostum sniffed, less than he needed. He was most offended when the Americans airdropped food for his horses, and the bags turned out to contain chaff. It was theoretically edible for livestock, but his horses refused to touch it. "United States is such a great country," Dostum said, chuckling. "Such a great people. But why is it so hard for them to give money?" There were more consequential challenges born of working with the warlords. Bart and the other Americans pulled watches to make sure they were always guarding their own. And there were headaches back at Langley. David, Tyson, the CIA operative, was with Dostum, but we also had Atta, Mohammed Noor, and one of the challenges we had was keeping those guys from killing each other, conceded Hank Crumpton wearily. "These guys are warriors. They've been killing people all their lives in one of the worst places on the planet." Still, most of the Americans were won over. "He had almost a boyish charm to him," Crumpton said of Dostum. "Had a good sense of humor, which I know masked a pretty ruthless capability. but I honestly enjoyed the conversation with him. Mostly, he said, he felt thankful for his partnership and for his leadership and what he and Atta and others accomplished on the battlefield. What they accomplished on the battlefield was, in immediate tactical terms, an overwhelming success. Bombing began in October, and over the course of November, the Northern Alliance warlords routed the Taliban from Mazar-e-Sharif in Afghanistan's north, and then Kabul, and then Kunduz in the northeast, where the Taliban surrendered after a 12-day siege. With each success came more prisoners of war. Some of these men were hardened fighters who had traveled from Pakistan and the Gulf states to join Osama bin Laden. But many others were ordinary Afghan men and boys, foot soldiers for a regime that had medieval values but little interest in the global jihad of the Saudi rich kid zealot it safeguarded. In late November, General Dostum and the Americans in Nuch's unit toppled Kunduz, a last redoubt for thousands of Taliban fighters. As many as 3,500 surrendered peacefully by one U.S. military estimate. The full count of prisoners was rumored to be twice that. The detainees were peeled off into separate groups. According to Bart, the Air Force controller, some were taken to a black site, another location which I can't talk about. The vast majority were taken west by Dostum's forces. Some were sent directly from a surrender point in the desert outside Kunduz to the prison at Dostum's headquarters in Shebergan. Others were sent to a different prison, a 19th-century fortress called Kala-i-Jangi, to be interrogated by the Americans. Kala-i-Jangi's high, muddied battlements had overlooked centuries of conflicts involving occupying forces, from the British to the Soviets. It was about to become the site of America's first casualty in the new war on terror. The prisoners at the fort rose up in a spectacular ambush, overpowering their American interrogators and killing one CIA agent, Mike Spann. A bloody 3-day siege followed. Dostum, who had been at Kunduz, returned along with Mark Nutsch and the other members of Team 595 to find an apocalyptic tableau of twisted metal and shredded bodies.
"The bodies," Dostum recalled, shaking his head. "They couldn't recognize who was my soldier, who was Al-Qaeda, who was Taliban."
Both the Americans and the Northern Alliance fighters were shaken by the loss of life and bitterly angry at the Taliban prisoners.
"I was crying for my horses," Dostum went on, his voice breaking.
Later, when Red Cross workers discovered one of those horses alive, "I was just crying from happiness, and I ordered my people to take him right away to the hospital for treatment." He named the horse Kookcha, or Bluish, and eventually took to riding it in battle himself. For the Americans, the first U.S. casualty of the new war made for a very painful realization of the price we paid for going very fast with very few people on the ground, said Crumpton, the CIA official. Also, it opens up a question of who has responsibility for prisoners of war. That question was tested almost immediately, as Dostum's men loaded the survivors from Kala-i-Jangi into trucks and transported them west again to join the rest of the prisoners in Shebergan. By January 2002, questions about the fate of these detainees were bleeding across Afghanistan's borders and into international headlines. When Jennifer Leaning and John Heffernan arrived that month, even the Red Cross, generally a vault about anything they've witnessed to maintain impartiality and access to prisoners in need, seemed to be raising flags. "Go north," a Red Cross lawyer in Kabul urged them. Leaning pressed her. "You mean the prisoners from Kunduz?" The lawyer nodded. "That was all we got, but it was enough," recalled Heffernan. The investigators made their way to the prison, a squat fort with peeling white paint on its clay brick walls and rusted metal bars securing its windows. International visitors had not, thus far, been welcome at the site. One early attempt to gain access by the Red Cross was barred by two American military officers, according to multiple accounts given to Leaning and Heffernan. But they were able to build rapport with a warden who was troubled by what he was witnessing inside the prison's weather-beaten walls, and quietly let them in. They quickly found confirmation of the rumors they had already heard. Through Pakistani translators, prisoners told anguished stories of starvation, overcrowding, and a mounting death toll. They pleaded for food, water, and medical attention. But Leaning and Heffernan noticed something else. The numbers didn't add up. The number of people held in the prison at Shebergan was not the number of people we heard were captured in Kunduz, she told me. As many as 7,000 to 8,000 had supposedly been captured. We saw perhaps 3,000 being held. The question was, where are the rest? It was that question that led the investigators to the Dashti Leili Desert the next day, and to the corpses, possibly thousands. What happened to the missing prisoners? How did these men and boys end up in such a tomb, in such a place? And, a question no one inside the U.S. government wanted to touch for more than a decade after, what did Americans on the ground know and see as the earth was moved and the grave was filled with body after body? We made a deal with Dostum for the territory he could take for us, for the blood he could spill of enemies we shared. What was the price? What did we give up when we shook his hand? How did all the talk of smaller footprints and partner forces hold up against a femur sticking out of the dirt? These were familiar ethical quandaries in America's national security-sensitive alliances. But, like the smell in the desert, they had become unusually hard to ignore here. In the years after the investigators discovered the grave in the desert, the alliances with warlords reshaped Afghanistan. Anti-Soviet Mujahideen fighters, armed by the Americans, who had turned into Northern Alliance commanders, armed by the Americans, finally turned into governors and ministers, installed by the Americans, or at least with their tacit assent and minimal grumbling. Atta Mohammed Noor, as governor of Balkh province, handed out parcels of land to loyalists and grew fabulously wealthy taking cuts of the province's customs revenue. His militias were implicated in sundry thuggery from murder to kidnapping to extortion. Ismail Khan, who became governor of Herat and then minister of water and energy, was accused of harassing ethnic Pashtuns and withholding provincial revenue from the government. A commander named Mir Alam became chief of police in the Baghlan province and developed a reputation for his spectacular corruption and support for drug mafias. A 2006 U.S. embassy cable concluded that Alam and another commander continued to act as Mujahideen commanders rather than professional police officers, abusing their positions of authority to engage in a broad range of criminal activity, including extortion, bribery, and drug trafficking. The governor of Nangarhar province, Gul Aga Sherzai, wreaked similar havoc there, from murder to drug trafficking to corruption benefiting his tribe. And then there was General Dostum, who served as deputy defense minister before eventually becoming vice president. Robert Finn, the first U.S. ambassador in Kabul after 9/11, struggled with the warlords, especially Dostum and Atta, who were frequently at each other's throats. It made for a stark parable. The two warlords were sitting on oil reserves that had produced hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues during the Soviet era and could easily have been exploited for Afghan reconstruction better and earlier. I tried to talk Dostum and Atta into becoming rich people, Finn recalled, but they'd rather kill each other over cows. So it went with opportunities to rebuild Afghanistan. Many of these men had been paid by the Americans for decades. Some traded tattered fatigues for slick suits as they grew rich off of drug deals. But most continued to behave as they always had, as warlords. Only now they were warlords ruling with the imprimatur of a central government backed by the United States, and a steady stream of lucrative international contracts to skim from. Finn came to believe the warlords were at the heart of many of Afghanistan's broader problems. Ministries were initially handed out to different warlords, and they started running them as their fiefdoms, so that was a problem, he told me. But the warlords were hard to shake, in some cases because of their tenacious grip on local power structures, and in some cases because there had never been a serious effort to empower alternatives. Often, the choice the Americans were left with was rule by warlord or complete chaos. Atta, for instance, led one of the most stable provinces in the country. Pushing him out was the last thing on the minds of the Americans. I think we should have worked ourselves away from them, Finn reflected years later. I understand what happened. We went in and said, okay, who can we get to help us? But that doesn't mean you stick with them forever. I think we have stuck with them too long. Once they're there, it's difficult to get rid of them. The United States' inability to reshape its relationships in Afghanistan, to forge a new set of bonds with civilian politicians who might counterbalance the entrenched culture of warlordism, reflected a deeper ill. America's objectives in Afghanistan had turned from conquest to development, but the diplomatic muscle had atrophied. The consequences of shuttered embassies and a withered foreign service around the world had come to a head in America's most important war. There weren't enough diplomats, and those in service didn't have the resources or the experience needed to tackle Afghanistan. There wasn't the background of experience, Finn said. Diplomats were all there for a very short period, so they learn anew every year. The people that were there over time, people like Dostum and the other warlords, they know how to use the Americans. They know exactly what to say and what the Americans would want them to say. The warlords' footholds in those American-backed power structures bedeviled efforts to create accountability. The mystery of Dostum's missing prisoners was a prime example. Two successive American presidents effectively evaded questions about the matter. The Bush administration quashed at least three efforts to investigate the grave across multiple agencies. An FBI agent at Guantanamo Bay began hearing stories about a mass killing from other Taliban prisoners who had survived, but was told to stand down and leave the matter to the military. The Pentagon, in turn, conducted only a brief, informal inquiry, asking members of Team 595 if they had seen anything, then issuing a blanket denial. There was, one senior Pentagon official recalled later, little appetite for this matter within parts of DOD. At the State Department, Colin Powell assigned the investigation to Ambassador-at-Large for War Crimes Pierre Prosper, who quickly saw opposition from both Afghan and American officials. They would say, "We've had decades of war crimes. Where do you start?" he recalled. His office later dropped the inquiry. When President Obama entered office, there was renewed hope. During a CNN interview in 2009, he went off script to promise an investigation. It seems clear that the Bush administration resisted efforts to pursue investigations of an Afghan warlord named General Dostum who was on CIA payroll. It's now come out there were hundreds of Taliban prisoners under his care who got killed. Anderson Cooper began gamely. "Right," said President Obama. Cooper mentioned the mystery of the mass grave and asked if Obama would call for an investigation into possible war crimes. "Yeah," said the president. "The indications that this had not been properly investigated just recently was brought to my attention. So what I've asked my national security team to do is collect the facts for me that are known, and we'll probably make a decision in terms of how to approach it once we have all the facts gathered up." "But you wouldn't resist categorically an investigation?" Cooper pressed. "I think that, you know, there are responsibilities that all nations have, even in war. And if it appears that our conduct in some way supported violations of the laws of war, then I think that, you know, we have to know about that." But no one at the Obama White House wanted to touch the issue either. As the State Department official charged with communicating with non-governmental groups, I was on the receiving end of some of the calls from groups like Physicians for Human Rights. Again and again, I pressed White House staff to disclose something, anything, to allow me to convene a meeting about the grave and at least listen, if not talk. The response was always the same. No comment, no meetings. I spent all day on the phone with the NSC, having them tell me to stall meetings we had set up with human rights groups because they're afraid of questions about the Dashti Laili massacre and don't want to cop to the fact that we've completely abandoned POTUS's promise to investigate, I wrote to Holbrook's communications director, Ashley Baumer, in March 2010. In a briefing document prepared the same month, there was a bullet point under my outreach to human rights groups. Dashti Laili with Physicians for Human Rights, working with NSC to formulate a clearer position. In another memo I filed 10 months later, the sentence had not changed. Frustrated with the executive branch's obstructions, human rights groups tried turning to Congress. In early 2010, another Physicians for Human Rights investigator, Nathaniel Raymond, received testimony from a former translator for American forces at Kunduz and Kala Ijangi, who had gone on to secure asylum in the United States. He claimed to have witnessed what happened to the prisoners, and whether Americans were present. Raymond brought the information to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and its lead investigator at the time, former CIA agent John Kiriakou, who was later sentenced to 30 months in prison for disclosing the identity of a fellow CIA officer. He has maintained that this was a principled act of whistleblowing on the government's use of torture in the global war on terrorism. He considered the story about the grave to be explosive. According to Kiriakou, the reaction from his superiors, including committee chair John Kerry, was explosive, too, and not what he expected. The staff director at the time, Frank Lowenstein, got wind of it and called me into his office and said, "Cease and desist immediately." Stunned, Kiriakou claimed he took the matter to Kerry directly. Kerry came down to the office afterwards and said, "What is this I'm hearing about Afghanistan?" said Kiriakou. I told him, and he said, "You've spoken to Frank?" And I said, "Yeah, Frank called me in and said to kill it." He said, "Okay." I got up and said, "So what do I do?" And he said, "You kill it." I said, "All right, I'll kill it." And that was the end of it. Kiriakou saw it as a pragmatic call on Kerry's and Lowenstein's part. Frank devoted his life to protecting John Kerry, and John Kerry wanted nothing more in the world than to be Secretary of State. And so we just couldn't risk any kerfuffle, even if it was historical in nature, anything controversial. So we killed it. It was a shame. I was very disappointed. Kerry said, "I've never heard anything about this, ever," and maintained that he never pulled punches on Afghan human rights during his time on the committee. Frank Lowenstein at first similarly denied having any recollection of the conversations with Kiriakou, then later suggested that Kiriakou might have interpreted, or he might have come away from our conversation with the impression that that wasn't something that I was particularly interested in pursuing, but I certainly never would have told him to kill it. In that interview in 2009, President Obama had pledged to open a new inquiry into the massacre. 4 years later, after intermittent refusals to comment to reporters, the White House quietly acknowledged that an investigation had been completed, but would remain sealed. A spokesperson mentioned a finding that no U.S. personnel were involved. The White House otherwise declined to elaborate. "It's cowardice," Raymond told me. "I was interviewed by the NSC as part of the investigation. It went nowhere because it wasn't what they wanted to hear." Physicians for Human Rights, through sheer tenacity, did eventually secure a handful of meetings with senior officials. The group also sent more than a dozen letters to officials across the government. Neither tack produced clarity. The consequences were real and specific. After an initial series of forensic missions, and before additional teams could return for a full excavation, the mass grave disappeared. In 2008, a UN team found, where the site had been, a series of large holes, and none of the bodies that had been previously documented. It was exactly the eventuality human rights advocates had been fighting to prevent. "From square one," said Susanna Serkin of Physicians for Human Rights, "we realized if anything leaked, the site would very likely be destroyed." It did leak, and world powers did nothing to protect the evidence. "There's now a second layer of violation," Serkin told me, "the literal obstruction of investigation and suppression of information by the U.S. government." My inability to cut through that indifference weighed on me. When I set out for Kabul years later, I was determined to come back with answers. For almost 15 years, General Dostum never sat for a detailed interview on the missing prisoners and the mass grave. But after months of conversation, he warmed to the idea of an audience with me. Securing an interview with General Dostum involves a lot of waiting. There was a year of conversations with his advisors who travel on his behalf in New York and Washington, all of them loyal Uzbek Afghans, some of them younger men from Dostum's Shebergan stronghold, who grew up steeped in legends of his heroism. There were introductions to his young sons, Batur, who was being groomed for a career in politics, and Babur, who was in the Afghan Air Force. And then there was a sudden call. Could I be on a flight to Kabul the next day? General Dostum would see me. I agreed, then crafted an email to a dear friend whose wedding the next night I'd have to miss as a result. Diplomacy in that region is ongoing. Arriving in Kabul on the appointed day, General Dostum did not see me. General Dostum was tired. General Dostum, an advisor informed me gravely, had a cold. I waited, like Gay Talese at a nightclub. I strolled the dusty streets of Kabul. I drove through security checkpoints to the bunker-like U.S. embassy for meetings with American officials. I sipped coffee with Dostum's advisors in the gardens of Kabul's Serena Hotel in sweltering late August heat. Eventually, they asked if I would join a meeting between General Dostum and women's rights activists from across Afghanistan. This was central to what Dostum wished to communicate to me and, by extension, the Western world. He, unlike some of the other holdovers from the Cold War, had a more progressive view of women.
"I'm probably among the very limited people in Afghanistan who are strongly committed to the rights of women, to protect women," Dostum later told me.
The conviction appeared to be sincere, and he repeated it often over several days of interviews. But General Dostum did not show up for the meeting with the women's activists either. An advisor presented me instead. A dozen formidable women had gathered in a cavernous government meeting hall under a mural inscribed with a verse from the Quran. "Never will Allah change the condition of a people until they change it themselves." Each had a personal appeal, from the teacher who begged for better wages to the lawyer who called for more women in government. At the first mention of the vice president's absence, whispers of surprise and disappointment ran through the room. A doctor, who had traveled several hours from the Logar province, left in tears. By the time I finally got the call telling me that General Dostum was ready, it was late at night. Once I had made my way through the layers of barricades and armed guards to the golden gates of the vice presidential palace, there was another hour of waiting in his strange, grass-carpeted parlor. When General Dostum entered the room, it was 10 p.m. The feared warrior was now in his 60s. His hair had thinned and whitened, and his gut had expanded prodigiously. But he was still imposing, a slab of a man, built like a refrigerator. His attire, Western jackets over flowing Uzbek robes, accentuated his size. He lumbered into the room and slumped into an ornate throne with a high, carved wood back and gold upholstery dusted with fleur-de-lis. Dostum's eyes, narrow under Asian epicanthic folds, reflected his ancestry, which he claimed could be traced back to Genghis Khan, who got around after all. Dostum rubbed his eyes and yawned. The much-discussed cold may well have been real, but others, including a former American ambassador to Afghanistan, said the general's late starts were attributable to something else. "He continues to have an extremely violent temper, he's an alcoholic, he is non-functional," that ambassador alleged. "He needs to leave the country to dry out more than he can be here." Through several of our meetings, Dostum nursed an undisclosed beverage out of an ostentatious designer mug stamped with a gold and rhinestone-crusted Chanel logo. I wondered if his previous meeting had been with the Kardashians or something.
"I don't know why sometimes the media don't express the reality," Dostum was grumbling.
I had hit record on my phone, and a handler had immediately asked that I stop. A minor fuss had ensued when I had insisted I continue. Dostum glanced at the phone unhappily.
"Unfortunately, nowadays, sometimes journalists, New York Times, they wrote so many things."
He frowned, that same wounded look crossing his face.
"He massacred human rights. He killed Taliban prisoners. He did this or that. My American friends from the CIA and other people, they came to my house and they said, 'Listen, they are portraying you in the United States this way, but we know you are a different person.'"
General Dostum was not wrong about his portrayal in the Western press. Human rights groups had brought well-documented charges of mass atrocities and murders against Dostum dating back to the 1990s. Press reports blamed him for violent reprisals against political rivals and their families, and even, on occasion, allies who strayed from loyalty. Human Rights Watch had, just days before I sat down with Dostum, accused his Junbish militias of murdering and assaulting civilians under the guise of anti-Taliban operations. Even Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, who selected Dostum as his running mate to exploit his status as a vote bank, commanding enduring popularity among Afghanistan's ethnic Uzbeks, once called Dostum a known killer. The U.S. State Department had echoed Ghani, calling Dostum the quintessential warlord, and then went a step further and denied him a visa to travel to the United States. The root of the criticism, he insisted, was political.
Our opponents, they fabricate a lot of things against us to give a wrong picture to the American public, he said.
The charge that he had assaulted political rivals was, he added,
a very unfair allegation. It's a political motivation. The reason why is, first, I have risen from a very deprived ethnic group. The second, I was from a poor family. Third, I had a vision for Afghanistan. I wanted justice, decentralized system, federalized system. All the people in Afghanistan, including my people, should have the same rights. So therefore they started blaming me unfairly.
The same, he said, was true of the alleged rampages of his forces.
I went to the northern part of Afghanistan and we fought alongside Afghan security forces to provide security for the provinces. People were so happy. We've done so many good things for the people.
He frowned again.
But instead of appreciating and saying thank you, they started again these political allegations. I believe that even Human Rights Watch and other human rights organizations are not just pure human rights organizations. They are also political. They fabricate what they want against you.
The visa denial seemed to have stung on a personal level for Dostum, who still regarded the Americans who armed him against the Taliban as blood brothers.
I believe I have been betrayed by my American friends. We fought together, and after all these things, it's a betrayal. But still the United States does not have another strong friend like Dostum. They don't have it.
The Americans, he felt, had used him
like tissue paper.
Indignant, he rattled off a list of friends who still stood by him, which included various military officials, an NYPD commissioner, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Hillary Clinton, with whom he claimed to have bonded over women's rights.
Miss Clinton, by then she was senator, she visited Kabul, they invited me. I told the story of that American lady who was coordinating the Air Force operation in Kunduz. Then she laughed and said, you should come to the United States and you should share this story with female pilots there.
He paused, eyeing me again.
So she also invited me to visit the United States, he repeated, in case I hadn't gotten that part.
When Clinton came to Kabul for Hamid Karzai's inauguration, Richard Holbrooke had swooped in to prevent her from shaking Dostum's hand. In any case, the father of a slain CIA agent had given him a key to the city of Winfield, Alabama.
I don't need any visa, Dostum sniffed. I have the key. I can go any time I want.
Still, Dostum appeared to realize that his image was in need of renovation.
It's our fault we couldn't tell the American public what kind of good friend to the United States we are.
He sighed. For him, the real story had always been simple.
You have a strong, bad enemy like Al-Qaeda who is terrorizing your people, and also you have a strong and good friend like Dostum who is ready to fight against your enemy and avenge the blood of your people who innocently were killed in the United States.
Dostum, like an Afghan Bob Dole, referred to himself in third person a lot.
We're partners, he went on. We fought against the same enemy for a good cause.
This was General Dostum as seen by himself, or at least how he hoped reporters like me would see him. A misunderstood champion of his people. He was an animal lover who wept over injured deer. A warlord with a heart of gold. The people's warlord. He was even, briefly, a fitness guru, responsible for Fitness for All, the Kabul equivalent of Michelle Obama's Let's Move.
When he needed to fight, he did that, but now we need peace, and he is doing this,
a security guard at the palace told reporters when the program rolled out.
It will encourage the young to start doing sports when they see the vice president exercising every morning.
Behind him, General Dostum, clad in athleisure, did jumping jacks. Photos of Dostum huffing and puffing his way through aerobic sessions, overlaid with Dari slogans, were liked by thousands of loyal followers on his official Facebook page. Exercise. Today's willpower, tomorrow's show of vigor, one was captioned. Sports attire is the attire of virtue, added another. Do you resent the term warlord? I asked Dostum.
The war was imposed on me, he said. If any enemy comes to your home, what should you do? You have to defend yourself.
He thought for a moment.
Not warlord, he decided. I would say, peace lord.
At this, the eyebrows of General Dostum's loyal translator shot up. When I asked him about the mass grave at Dashti Leili, Dostum initially gave the same answer the Americans had given for years.
There are so many graves, he said, shaking his head. So many bodies.
These, he swore, were from other periods, from when he was in exile in Turkey before 9/11, and his second-in-command betrayed him. It was that commander, Malik, he said, who was responsible for most of the bodies in the desert. But specifically, I pressed, the prisoners from Kunduz after the uprising at Kala Ijangi. Dostum grunted wearily. He'd been waiting for this.
The fact is, they took the prisoners in Kunduz on the open lorry car sent to Shebergan.
Dostum said he, personally, had seen to it that the prisoners were loaded. It was an ugly process.
Some of them run, some were hiding, he conceded.
But they were, when he was there, in open trucks. This was very possibly true as far as that particular leg of the journey went. But according to multiple eyewitness accounts, the convoy from Kunduz didn't go directly to Shebergan. Instead, it, and eventually surviving prisoners from the uprising at Kala Ijangi, stopped at a fort called Kala Izeni. One driver who talked to the press in 2002 said he had been hired to drive a closed container truck, the kind with a sealable metal enclosure for freight, generally about 40 feet by 8, to the site. According to him, other drivers, and surviving prisoners, Dostum's men herded screaming detainees into the containers. In some cases, they hogtied prisoners and threw them in. 10 prisoners who survived and made it to Guantanamo Bay told an FBI official they were stacked like cordwood, hundreds to a truck, before the doors were slammed and locked. A villager told reporters that those who didn't move fast were beaten viciously. The only purpose of the operation, he said, was to kill the prisoners. The horror stories that survivors told are what followed Dostum most forcefully all those years. They spoke of screaming and beating the walls, of licking sweat and urine to stave off death by dehydration, of gnawing each other's limbs from hunger or madness. It was a well-worn method of execution in the Afghan desert, locking prisoners in containers and allowing them to burn alive or suffocate depending on the season. That November, the cold air would have made suffocation and dehydration the method of killing. Dostum's men allegedly carried out the entire operation. Each driver was joined by at least one soldier in the cab of the truck. When drivers tried to punch holes in the containers for ventilation or to discreetly pass in water bottles, they claimed they were beaten by Dostum's forces. Survivors claimed that in some cases, those soldiers even opened fire directly into the trucks, silencing the screams. The drivers who talked said the convoys continued for days. A top-secret cable sent by the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research concluded that, "We believe the number of Taliban deaths during transport to Shebergan prison may have been higher than the widely reported 1,000. A three-letter U.S. intelligence agency, redacted in the version of the cable released through a Freedom of Information Act request, puts the number at least 1,500, and the actual number may approach 2,000. Dostum sighed when I raised the allegations. In the past, one of his spokespeople had said only that there were accidental deaths from pre-existing injuries. Dostum told me a different story.
The road, he explained, it was closed. Chimtal Road and also Balk Road was closed because the Taliban was there, revolting.
Most of the prisoners, he insisted, stayed in open cars.
But in probably one container there is Taliban.
One container? I asked. This would allow for perhaps 1/6 of the count given by even the most conservative eyewitness estimates. In one container, Dostum's translator said confidently. As he spoke, Dostum began tilting his head back and forth, jutting out his lower lip, reconsidering.
"Probably 2 or 3 containers," he conceded.
"Who put them in the containers?" I asked.
"This commander, the local commanders who were supposed to transfer them, probably they were scared because of revolt in Kalaijangi. The road was blocked in Chimtal and Balk. They thought they might also escape and they will attack them, and they put them in 2 or 3 containers."
I asked for a name. Dostum was impatiently wiggling his knees again.
"The commander, his name was Kamal Khan. He was one of them, yeah."
Dostum ran a hand down one side of his face.
"Plus one commander, his name was Hazarat Chunta. He probably opened fire."
Dostum and his aides didn't suggest that either commander had faced repercussions for the incident, and said they were unsure of where they were years later. Dostum sidestepped questions as to exactly how much of this he had ordered. The fact that prisoners had died, he said, was a surprise. According to his version of events, he was eating lunch at Kunduz when an aide arrived to inform him.
"Some Taliban prisoner were killed in container," the aide told him, "and I asked them, 'Have you showed them to Red Cross?' They said no. Then I was very upset with him. 'Why didn't you show it to the Red Cross? You are just trying to undermine my credibility. My enemies will use it against me. I'm trying to be fair in this war. You had to show it to the Red Cross.'"
But according to the Physicians for Human Rights investigators, the Red Cross didn't gain access until weeks later, when the killing was done and the secrets buried. I struggled to envision Dostum telling anyone to call the Red Cross, ever. Whatever Dostum's knowledge of the deaths, the available evidence suggests that he was involved in the subsequent cover-up. The declassified State Department intelligence cables said more needed to be done to protect witnesses who were disappearing. Dostum and one of his commanders had been implicated in abuses perpetrated against several witnesses connected with the events surrounding the Dashti Leili site. One eyewitness reported to have operated a bulldozer used at the site to bury bodies was killed, and his body discovered in the desert. At least 3 Afghans who worked on issues involving the mass grave have been beaten or are missing. The UN concluded that still another witness was imprisoned by Dostum's forces and had been tortured. I had to ask Dostum twice about the disappearing witnesses. Finally, I handed him a copy of the cable itself. He eyed it with no discernible reaction, then handed it to an aide. "Is it possible," I asked, "this accusation that witnesses were killed and intimidated afterwards?" He shrugged.
"I don't know. I don't recall."
Thornier still was the question of how much the Americans saw. The witness whose testimony Nathaniel Raymond brought to John Kerry and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee had been a translator for American forces at Kunduz and Kalaijangi. He claimed to have been present during the transfer of prisoners into containers and to have witnessed 2 Americans in blue jeans, speaking English, at the site watching the proceedings. Who's going to be at Dashti Leili on November 30th and December 1st, 2001, speaking English and wearing blue jeans? Raymond said.
"When I left Kalaijangi, all the time American colleagues accompanied me," Dostum told me.
He was adamant about this, a point of personal pride for him as he defended his faltering relationship with the nation that had used him to achieve victory and now seemed intent on turning its back on him. He said that Mark Nutsch, the captain of Special Forces Team 595, had been by his side almost constantly, an assertion Nutsch said was generally accurate. "Yeah," he recalled, "we worked very closely with Dostum nearly every day." "Were any of the Americans assigned to Kalaizani, where the containers were loaded?" I asked Dostum.
"All of them was with me," he replied, tapping his foot impatiently. "They wrongly accused," he added, referring to suggestions in the human rights community that Americans may have been involved in the slaughter. "They say, 'Oh, Dostum, he killed, Americans were firing.' It's not true."
Dostum offered this exoneration as evidence of his loyalty to the Americans. But his conviction that the Americans were by his side during the incident raised another set of difficult questions about whether the Special Forces and CIA personnel witnessed any of the communications between Dostum and his commanders about the murders, and failed to either stop them or report them after the fact. Nutsch told me he knew of no abuses. "My team has been investigated multiple times over this," he said. "We did not witness nor observe anything." Just as Dostum considered the American Special Forces blood brothers, the camaraderie was apparent on Nutsch's side. "I saw him as a charismatic leader, led from the front,